That's a new outline of the kennel list, and I tried to redo it to make it a little bit simpler. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Are you ready? Quick review. We did the lecture to the strangers last time, in which Polly tried to see the pattern in chance, which is not a bad idea in and of itself, but for him it was an attempt to structure what is really unstructurable. And if it is unstructurable, it's only structurable in hindsight. That's one of the weird things. You can see it behind you, but you can never see it in front of you. Of course, he didn't like that idea. Then the response to that from even within the active imagination, let's call it that, it's not really, but was that the lady says that the he has fathered an illegitimate child on her, which would suggest that what has just preceded is indeed illegitimate. And the problem is he doesn't have his passport. And that, I thought, was so important. The passport would mean, does he know what he's about? And does he accept what he's about? And I'm afraid we have to say no. I mean, he knows it intellectually, but not emotionally. Then there's the business that he won't see the promised land, and the lady says that is good. And I questioned that last bit, her saying that's good. So she is not totally trustworthy. She's infected by the shadow, probably. Right. Yeah. Piano. Yeah, she's partly, for a while she's the piano teacher, and then she becomes the Chinese woman.
It almost seems like she becomes, as opposed to the animal, as though she becomes part of consciousness at times when she's speaking.
Well, or the witch.
You know?
That's the way the witch works.
Well, she seems so demurring to his conscious opinions at times. It's almost as though she is not, you know, it was like von Franz said, well, there was too much detail in this for it to be an active imagination. Mm-hmm. It was too structured. Mm-hmm. I feel that structure come out in some of the things she says as though she's just his mouthpiece.
I'd say she's the mouthpiece of his negative mother complex, of his negative anima. That's the way the negative anima works. She
encourages the things that aren't good for you.
Well, yes, she affirms your wrong path, and she attacks your right path. And her kindness is dangerous because she's kind to you when you fail. And she persecutes you when you succeed. You know, these are always difficult questions. I have to answer it on two levels. I think typically, no. What the animus does typically is criticize. Or idealize. Makes the woman feel very big or very small. Inflates her or deflates her. Now, I said I have to answer that at two levels. Having said that, this is so difficult because I think it's changing today. And so I said what Jung classically said. And in any case, as you probably know, if I haven't said it, bear with me while I say it again, that what Jung says about all these things, and what I'm saying about all these things, is merely the top of the bell curve. It's, on average, this is the way it works. But you can find plenty of exceptions to what I said. So just so you remember, I'm saying it in that spirit. But two, I think it's changing. Anyway, yeah, I've told you that little gimmick I use when I introduce the anima and animus, and that to me, it couldn't be clearer that it's changing. I've learned. Be careful with this one. not so bad now. Things have quieted down, but 15 years ago, people got mad when you talked about this stuff. I ask the women to think of all the men they've loved, and the men to think of all the women they've loved. And you know, there's always some gay person who says, "Yeah, what about me? I'm gay." I don't think it matters. I didn't say in love with or sleeping with, just have love during your life. And certainly for heterosexuals, it's very often, you know, the romantic, but not limited to. And then I ask them to write down the qualities that, if they think of it as 3 to 5 to 10 people, what did they have in common? And then write that down and then hand it in. And then I put it up on the board. What the women said about the men they admired or were loved, in love with, sleeping with, love. And the men about the women. It's right out of you. You know, you can't dispute that. However, I make two columns. I say this is what Jung typically said, and this is what is being said today apart from what's typically said. And you can see there's a shift. And I have to explain to them, you know, Jung didn't have some opinion about what masculine and feminine was. He just heard what people associated, and what he reported, which is the top of the bell curve, is what they associated. If he heard them associating today, which is what I essentially asked the group to do, he would have changed his idea. That's how I deal with that one. But, I mean, still, I think it's dangerous, of course, to generalize, but it's not incorrect to say... there is a kind of a top of the bell curve here. Oh, because they say he's saying that masculinity is and femininity is, and oh my God, where are you? Oh yeah, I had people just red beet face arguing with me about that. He's a sexist. You can't say that's masculine, that's feminine. It's culturally relative. That was all the argument.
So you see it changing in what direction?
Well, that the animus is becoming more like the anima. And the anima becoming more like the animus. And really, the best, it's a little bit off our point, but it's interesting anyway. The best I think I ever heard this was, I talked about this with Jung's grandson, and I like the way he put it. He said he thought that, you know, if Jung had it to do over again, he would have said that they're really the same thing, with a slight difference in emphasis. That the animus leans towards this, the anima leans towards that. And that strikes me, because the common element is when you fall into these things is how unreasonable you become.
Generated by a negative mother, mm-hmm. archetypal energy, for the woman it would be her shadow, right? Mm-hmm. And the man would be, you would call it animal because it's female.
Right.
But the whole point, though, is the energy of trying to get you affirm your wrong path and kill your right path is the negative mother energy.
Yeah.
So even though the dream image is... And that's true for women.
I think that's true across the board. Absolutely. I can still remember my mother saying as a kid, "Oh, it's cold, don't go outside." That's the witch. Why shouldn't I go outside if it's cold? I want to go out and play. But that kindness holds the boy back. And I had that sort of a mother, but other mothers will say, you know, "You selfish bastard, don't go out and play, do the dishes." I mean, above and beyond the norm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In the cloud, especially I think in the Old Testament, there is this idea of the great prophet or leader not seeming to begin the journey, like Moses.
Yeah.
What does that say? Is that related at all to what is coming out here?
Well, of course, we had that, that he says he's not going to see that promised land.
Yeah. Is that at all related?
You know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, Edinger has that book, Individuation, Symbolism in the Old Testament. Do you have that?
No, I haven't.
You might enjoy it. It's very well done.
Oh.
I don't know what he says. I'd be curious what he says. My response would be to take it on two levels again, that, you know, we're not going to see the end of this journey we're on here. What we're doing is preparing the way for kids. I feel so strongly. This is our gift to the next generation, or generations. There's no way in hell we're going to get this clear. And so part of the journey is going on the journey even though you know you're not going to finish it.
And providing the presence of mind that those coming after have to continue that.
Yeah. And
it's not over with.
Now, that's the positive sense. I think his sense of it here is it's just, you know, poor me.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why he can't fulfill his task and get to the promised land, mm-hmm. which would mean to stand up for what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So there it's negative.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole Hebrew journey is just a wonderful metaphor for what individuation is. That's why Edinger's book is called Individuation Symbolism in the Old Testament. It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, I discovered Edinger through you all. I didn't know that he was such a quiet person. I got to get to him. I don't know any of his books yet.
Oh, yeah. He's a treat. He's a Hoosier, too. He's probably
yeah, I found that out.
From Bedford.
It doesn't seem that maybe you might
read it for him. We did once.
Oh, did we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were there or not, but
I want the taste. But never the book.
Huh. I could always do it again. Yeah, it's powerful. Yeah. Let's see. And that couple of details now, 134. I think we can skim pretty quickly because we've touched on the main points. Second paragraph of 134, he goes back to the men's world. Bad news. He says, I will try to reconcile the master at all costs. But that's his checks in the mail. We'll see how many times he betrays that. I think it's a true statement where he says, now that he has been reconciled, in other words, now that the master has been given the idea he could be understood, that gives the woman her dignity back. Because she is the emotional component of this worldview that we're trying to understand. Bad news, about two-thirds of the way down, my consciousness will always be with my lady. I took that to mean he will project what he needs to do onto her. And some of you have pointed that out, that he wanted von Franz to have his emotions, he wanted von Franz to work on his problem, and so on. Classic anima projection. You do for me what I'm not going to do for myself.
So you said he projects his what?
I think he projected his anima onto von Franz.
Well, I mean, about the lady, you said the significance of...
Oh, my consciousness will always be with
lady?
My lady,
yeah.
Meaning the Oriental woman / piano teacher.
Mm-hmm. What was the significance of that?
Well, that his consciousness should be to recognize what his task is. And he lets her worry about it. He doesn't worry about it.
Oh, I see.
Now, I must confess, I'm puzzled by the next sentence. Transformation of the center of evolution. Let's just keep that as an open question, what that is about. The center of evolution would be the self, or the God image. So one way to look at that is it's about the transformation of the God image which would be the impetus behind the paradigm shift that we're all involved in. That's one way to take it. That's a detail. The big image is the ring eye. Ring eye. At that moment, the lady slipped a ring from her finger, which I had not noticed before. She let it float in the air and taught me, I suppose you know the ring from your school of mathematics. It is the ring eye. And we're going to spend considerable time on that. This was the detail that I think put von Franz over the edge. This was the straw. That it's left hanging in the air. It is not taken up. And I thought the ring eye.
Oh.
So I thought we would spend some time on that ring eye, and it is terribly difficult to explain. I'm not sure I can do it, but I will try it with your patience. Now what happens to get the image is she pulls a ring off her finger and it floats in the air. End of piano lesson. That's the end of the story, basically. So it's a literal ring on her finger. The word that he uses to describe that, the ring eye, is also a mathematical concept. So it's a double meaning here. It's a physical ring, but it signifies a mathematical construct. And what we have to do now is try to understand what that mathematical construct is. So we're going to take a detour, and I'm going to try to talk about what I is in mathematics. It's a small I, italicized. It's a square root of negative 1. So now we have to take a journey into math. And we did this in number and time, so if you're a number and time, bear with me. It probably won't hurt to review, because I'm not sure I explained it well then, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to explain it well now. Because really, it doesn't make any sense. That's the problem. But you all know what a square root is, right? So if I go 4, I take the number 4, the square root of that is 2, right? Square root is what number times itself equals that number. So the square root of 4 is 2. Square root of 9 is 3. Square root of 16 is 4, and so on. So square root of 4 is 2. Square root of 9 is 3. And square root of 16. Now, of course, you get the square root of 4.2. It's a decimal. That's what your calculator does on this one. The problem is, what is the square root of negative 1? There are no two numbers that multiplied together equal negative 1. And that's the first thing you got to swallow. Because if you had a plus 1 and a plus 1, that would be plus 1. If you had a negative 1 times a negative 1, that'd be a plus 1. So there are no two numbers that can be multiplied together to get negative 1.
Is that the same as a cardinal number, then? Cardinal negative number?
No. Yeah. I don't know what a cardinal number is.
Well, I just thought anything that couldn't do. Then nothing going into it equally.
Oh, that's there's no such thing, is it? There's no such number apart from negative 1 that can't be broken down into itself times itself. You have to get decimals.
Oh.
You know, that's the difference. But you know, like say square root of 4 is 2. The square root of 2 is 1.14. I think, is that right? Does that sound right? I kind of forget. 1.1416. It's been a while since that happened. So you can square root any number, but you do get a decimal sometimes. But you can't square root negative 1 because there's no number that will equal that when you take it times itself. Now, mathematicians have simply given that a name and they call that I. Because it's imaginary. It physically doesn't exist. Now, what does that have to do with light? I don't know physics, but I can tell you from my engineering days, where this would come into play, you would be trying to investigate, say, the behavior of a transistor or whatever. And there's a formula that you use to investigate. You know this current, you know that, da 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 da, here's the result. Well, what happens when you mathematically, and this is where, if you don't have the experience, it's strange, even though I do have the experience, it's still strange, because it's physically impossible, and yet you do it. When you compute, you get a number made up of two parts. You get a number made up, let's say, 5.2, a real part, and then you get a number, which is an imaginary. So a calculation on a specific physical process from the mathematical rules leads to an answer made up of two parts, a real and imaginary. Now that means nothing in reality. This is all done on paper. Now, and the reason that you have to do it like that, if you want to take that result and examine it further, you have to have two parts to your equation or to the number you're working with so that it comes out later down the road correct. Does that make sense so far?
Say that last part again. So that it
the reason you have to do this is this may be the result of the first calculation. But then you want to put that element in another system and see how those two are going to interact. And you perform a mathematical operation that describes that behavior. You have to have both of these numbers as what you're using to input into the system.
To have a common ground?
To get the correct answer at the end.
So it unites the two systems, in other words, is what you're saying.
Well,
the imaginary numbers?
Yeah, it has to be there in the calculation phase for subsequent transformations to be accurate. And so you always have two factors you're working with, a real and imaginary. And there are laws about how they interact and so on, which you don't have to worry about. It's really not that complicated. But the concept that you're working with an imaginary number is hard to grasp. And I can tell you, no one grasps it in my field. You just work with it. You just accept it. Here's the result. Here's the steps you apply mathematically to this, and that gives you another imaginary number, another number made up of two parts. And then if you're going to transform it further, you apply your mathematical calculation to that number, you get another number. And then when it comes time to figure out what does that mean in reality, there's a way to break that down into what that physically refers to in terms of how loud a loudspeaker is or how fast your computer runs, or whatever you're calculating.
And then that doesn't have imaginary numbers.
Then that's gone. And, you know, I'm going to go a step at a time, but we'll see how that works out. Be okay with that, at least in principle. Now, remember all the geometry somewhere along the line, the Cartesian coordinates? If we plot out the number, this number on two coordinates. We call this the real. And this the imaginary. So this is I. This is minus I. This is just real plus, and then this is minus. So this number, if we would go, you know, 5.2 would be 5.2, and then 6.3. That number would be graphed here. Now, if you graph, yeah, okay with that. Here's the ring I know. If you graph all the combinations of these two numbers, which in reality turn out to be one, after you've done your calculations in this double phase.
It forms a circle. In other words, here is, that should be balanced. Here is 1. Here is I. Here is minus 1. Here is minus I. But the distance from the center to that circle is always 1. So this would be, this would be, let's say, minus, this would be 1, this would be 1, 0, I. This would be I, 0, plus I. And all these points here along the way would be some measure of a real number and some fraction of an imaginary number. How you determine what the real, this is where it gets very simple again. I mean, the concept is complicated, but the application is very simple. You simply go back to what's that triangle called?
Right triangle.
Yeah. So let's say I want to find this point is 1. This is 1. That 1 is made up of this much I and this much real. And this would be what actually you find in reality made up of these two parts. Is that nonsense or not? I don't know whether you're laughing at me or with me.
So could you boil it down into... its essence, why do we use I? What purpose does it serve?
Well, it's the... This is going to sound strange, but this is the way these people think. It's the result of a mathematical operation.
So we use I... as a sort of constant when we're calculating things that can have two different types of answers?
Yes.
A real quantity in time and space, in calculation, on the calculation level, is made up of two parts.
And the I is sort of a constant that underlies
one of those parts.
Two different types of mathematical calculations, or even more.
One of two types, yeah. It would be like, let's call this apples and this orange, oranges, that any meal is going to be made up of so many apples and so many oranges, and this is the amount of fruit you got. But because of the way apples and oranges interact, you have to do your calculations with apples one way and oranges another way, all throughout, even though eventually you go back and say it's fruit. It's weird. What's so weird about it is it doesn't have any physical reference. It doesn't exist anywhere. And What I can tell you from my own training is so weird is that you don't worry about that after a while. You're talking about terms that don't exist, and you're not concerned whether they exist or not. You're concerned about their interrelationship in a mathematical formula. But all at the end you say, now what does that turn out to be in reality? So all this calculation is done on a level apart from reality with no reference to reality. You can imagine, although mathematically there must be some connection, or the answer would turn out that.
So it helps me to go from that to apples and oranges.
That's maybe a better way to put it. I'm trying to think of a metaphor. And let's suppose, okay, here this might be, this is not exactly right, but let's suppose apples and oranges, when they got together, would turn to mush magically. So in your calculations, in counting apples and oranges, you've got to keep your apples separate. You can keep your oranges separate. You have to keep your, or you won't have apples or oranges at all. You'll have mush. And you don't want to get fruit cocktail until the end. So you have to keep them apart while you're preparing it. That might be good analogy in cooking. There are certain ingredients, right, you have to keep apart while you're cooking them. Because if you put them together too soon, it would be a mess. Right. And this is much the same way. During your calculation phase, you have to keep them separate. And then only at the end is there another mathematical operation to turn the separate entities back into something that equals a value you can test or hear or see or listen to or cook your meat in time and space.
So I went directly to animus and anima.
An interesting thing that...
No, it's not animus and anima.
That's why I'm bringing it up, because that's where I went to. And I'm not seeing where at the end, where would that... Thank you. And I was going for a third thing.
It's not like animus and anima, more like conscious and unconscious.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly. Okay. It is, now to go back to the text, it is I would equal spirit and the real would equal matter. So that any event in life is made up of spirit and matter, and their combination is what creates reality.
What is interesting in quantum theory is that you have these wave functions which have I contained within them.
Yeah.
And, but to get to something that is you can use to predict in terms of the energy and things like that in the real world, you generally will have to multiply one wave function against the other. So you end up multiplying I times I, and then you get
then you get one again. Right. You don't get minus one.
Right, you get a real number.
Right.
So that's I think that's pleasing to the mathematician that you are able to do some
predictive
functions that then get you away from the imaginary number.
Right.
And then you enter into the real.
Very well said. Yeah, the imaginary number exists only in the computation phase.
Right.
And then as you apply another set of transformation processes from the taking it from the imaginary to reality, it all cancels out. But you can't cancel it out at the beginning. You got to go through those two parts along the way, and then it cancels out at the end. So the ring I mean that is such a powerful pregnant image. This woman has connected with her and her eros. See, it's her finger. The whole issue of reality made up of two parts. The spirit, the imaginal, if you will, and time and space. And that's what she's giving Pali. You see, it's in mathematical language everything we've been talking about. And I don't know quantum stuff. I take your word for it, Deb. I certainly know my field, my old field. I mean, you couldn't do... You would have no TVs, you'd have no computers without this. This is how all the calculations are made. You learn this freshman year. A capacitor has a certain formula that when you examine how it works, gives you two figures. A coil, same way. Transistor, the same way. A real and imaginary. So you learn this right off the bat.
You know what's weird, too? It's dealing with synchronicity in the sense that it's using...
I would be synchronicity.
...outside to connect with the field. And yet then we also have quantum physics, which cannot be used as a predictor, almost that number I. Well, I guess you don't know the outcome until you do the calculation.
You don't know the outcome until you do the calculation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking how in quantum physics there is no way you can figure out where it's going to go. You know,
right.
Which is also a synchronistic
right. right.
imagery.
Right. And I think, you know, the thing I want to stress that you mentioned there is how, again, for a scientist working here, he's always working in two levels. Part of his numbers are real, part of his numbers are imaginary. And that's just what you do. And that is meant to communicate to Pali, that's how a true life is lived on two levels. The real, and what the self is asking of you, which we are calling the spirit. And as we've said, the big shift here is that the material world is now the carrier for the spirit world. And the parallel to that in this stuff is that any real number is made up of two factors and you cannot separate them. I mean, any physical result in life is made up of two factors and you can't separate them while you're in the figuring stage. When you live them out, they're a unity. But when you're figuring and trying to understand what's going on, it's a duality.
Well, in quantum theory, that reality, when you do the campus, mm-hmm. so that's why probably being hung up on chance, that number is a chance.
It's a probability.
It's function. A probability.
Yeah, right.
So, but electricity, uh-huh. Is that a problem?
No.
It's not a problem.
Well, I didn't get... I'm sure if you... You know, we don't pass the bachelor's, which is all I have. If you're doing science and materials, which is what you learned to build, you know, the chips themselves, yes, I bet you. Because then you're using quantum theory
right.
and applying it to the behavior
right.
of that
right.
material.
So you end up with a probability.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come out
right, right, right. Okay, well, I hope that it's not easy. And as I say, what is so weird is I don't understand it either. And the funny thing is, you just use it whether you understand it or not, because it's like another game with other rules, and you just do it, and you do it, and then at the end it leads to something, and you never really stop and think. Now, what does that refer to? It's just an operation on paper.
It's like synchronicity; you can't really define it.
It does lend itself as a metaphor to this process very well. The fact that two things have to occur, that obviously that one imaginary thing is important because it leads to a final result, and yet we have no idea what it is. It's a logical impossibility. Square root of negative one doesn't exist. And yet you use it. So I think, you know, Pali being a physicist, the psyche is speaking to him in his language here. And we could probably do it later. I don't know whether to do it now or do it later, but he had a dream about the unit circle. Maybe we'll do that later. At the end of the book, which is in the appendix. He saw four eggs. One egg go to two egg, go to three egg, go to four eggs. Those four eggs turned to four factors in a formula, and that formula was the formula for this circle. I think, now you're a little bit beyond me here, but I think if you wrote this in a formula, it's... Does that look right? Is that right? Yeah. Don't worry about that. But... it's an exponential. It's like 2.4 or something. I don't know. I forgot.
Well, was that formula already known?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like the Benzene ring that they got
through. You know, I don't know where it came from, but no, this would have been known. Yeah. Yeah, because as I say, you use this in many other fields besides quantum. I'm sure you use it even in building a bridge. You know, any time you're dealing with processes, that you need to be able to follow a process as opposed to a state. You know, how much does a bridge bend when a truck goes over it, and for two trucks and four trucks, all that kind of stuff. I think you would use this, but I don't know for sure, but I think so. Well,
I have to just say this. It just so startled me I looked up, and we were looking over at Karn, and just in a split second, it looks just like Moon.
You got to stop eating those mushrooms.
I am absolutely serious. One of those things in my heart just sort of stopped for a moment. I'm sure other people have told you that you do look like him.
Used to be Ted Turner.
There's a lovely combination. Moon and Turner. Oh, that was, it was like, he was saying something about being logical, and I went, ooh. I thought he'd reincarnated for a moment.
Did I ever tell you my Ted Turner movie story? What wealth is like? I was out in California a couple years ago in Berkeley, my old graduate school, and some friends and I went down to see a movie downtown, all these little funky theaters, you know, that seats 25 people or 30 people. This woman came up to me after the show and she says, "My God, you just look like Ted Turner." Did I tell you this? I said, "Well, I am Ted Turner." I said, "But look, you know, do you know how few places I can go where people just don't make a big deal? That's why I like Berkeley so much." He said, "Okay." He said, "But I'm a filmmaker. Would you invest $50,000 in my film idea?" I said, "Okay, but you have to go home with me." She said, "Okay." That's what money gets you.
What happened after?
I told her I wasn't.
Oh.
And she didn't go with me.
Well, I'm not falling for it. Okay? I think it's all on purpose you have on your refrigerator.
Right.
Holy
So you can see the ring eye is the problem. And that's all the stuff that's on top of 135. Marriage, static image, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't take it. I think that's the big point that upset her. So that, once again, he refuses to accept what he is being challenged to do.
He refuses to go through the process.
Yeah, well, I mean, specifically, the first place he would meet the unity of spirit matter is in his relationship to Von Fox. And that, as a portal to getting up the courage and having the kind of discussions that would help him to write the books he needed to write. So in refusing the ring, he refuses her. In refusing her, he refuses his task.
It's confusing when they talk about the atom because they're talking about it in the ancient Greek sense.
Uh-huh.
But then they throw it right into physics here, so...
Right. And I guess, you know, I don't know enough to say the I is a unity between particle and wave. That could be... I kind of doubt it's that simple. And that, you know,
that's what Polly said.
Right, but for my taste, the whole thing goes downhill after he refuses the ring. So you can just about forget what was said, because it doesn't matter. He's rejected it.
He refuses it, or just sort of ignores it.
Well, he ignores it. He ignores it. Yeah, he ignores it. And then the remain merciful. I don't understand that either. We'll talk about that. That's taken up later. And then the other thing was he's wearing his coat and hat. He's back to Herr Professor. And did I mention that I mistyped the chord? I think I did, didn't I? Did I tell you that? Yeah. It should be C-E-G-C. That's, others were not my mistake. This is my mistake. C-E-G-C. And I think Kathy said it doesn't resolve. Does not resolve, yeah.
It can be resolved, but not...
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's in and out, thank God.
You know, you're making an interesting point that we do a lot of calculation and... don't really understand how it works. But you know, it's really starting me, especially in reading Letterman's book on the Godfather, how many of the things that we use, in fact, probably most things we use in the calculation we use in physics, we really don't understand how it works.
Right.
And yet it can take us to the moon.
Yeah, right.
And we still don't know how it works. It's really kind of sobering when you think about
it. Right. Well, I remember. I remember him sitting in class and thinking, this stuff makes no sense. And I think really your my what I would call the beginning of my training as a student of science was to stop asking. And you don't ask, you just go along with these calculations with no idea what they refer to.
Yeah.
And you don't really care.
You wonder, that would be the point of it, which is, you know, it was undergirded in all of our modern technology, Newton's law of gravity, which you can calculate, you know,
mm-hmm.
how spheres are coordinated and how they mm-hmm. move around each other and how you can send a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't understand what causes gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the big question
yeah.
still to this day.
Yeah.
And that's probably why Newton probably went into algebra to try to understand that
yeah.
because he knew that he didn't really understand it,
yeah.
even though he could make calculations, you know, all those.
Well, what I came to realize is that science doesn't explain, it describes.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference. It just describes what goes on. It doesn't tell you what the thing is at heart. It just describes its behavior.
Does anything explain that?
No. Well, not in science.
No.
I mean,
in other areas
that's religion.
Oh, okay.
Jung, you know, sidesteps the whole thing and says there are only phenomena. So, you know, people will say, well, what does he think about reincarnation? He doesn't think about things. He describes behaviors, if you really look at his work. And so he feels that these questions of, you know, well, what really is the square root of negative 1 are meaningless because all we can know is our relationship to them. That's where he comes down. And the same with the God image. You know, that's what it really, where it applies practically to his work. And like, think, I mean, in a way we do it, we talk about dreams. We don't know where they come from. Are they brain chemistry? Are they divine? Are they, what's a neuron? Are they, you know, we do the same thing in a way.
I always think about, if I were to die this instant, all of my physical matter would still be here. But none of it would be working as my physical matter is
mm-hmm.
working. And that's what I just think, you know, that's where the spirit and the matter have not incarnated anymore. I find that fascinating. There's still serotonin, mm-hmm. there's still all of this stuff, but it's not, you can no longer use it for science.
Yeah.
I just find that idea.
Well, you could
use their body. Yeah. Well, you could for physically to see where things are,
uh-huh.
but you couldn't describe what they did because there's no life form that's allowing the processes to unfold.
I see.
All you can do is point and say, here's this and here's
yeah.
that and this is connected to this. But if you just found a dead body, you wouldn't know what vehicle for if it wasn't alive. You know, I just find that so fascinating. Like spirit has found its way into our bodies to animate it
mm-hmm.
in a particular way. But where does that particularity go from?
Right. And where does it come from? Who knows?
Where does it come from? Yeah.
Yeah. But like, you know, what the myth, I think, so to speak, gives us is a representation, and that's I. That's what I is about, as a metaphor. The imaginary. Which has to be one component mixed with reality to form a complete event. A complete meaningful event. Okay, over to 140? No, we did that. We've gone, we've essentially, we've already done chapter 13. That takes us to 152. Some of this I think we can go through kind of quickly. If you see anything in between, holler, but I think we pretty much did touch on the previous chapter as we went along following the text bit by bit. Okay. 152, the lady, second line, has slit eyes and lets the ring float in the air. That's what we talked about. And he'll never come to his home. We talked about that. Now, I think our author starts to lose it a bit. Third line, second paragraph, there is no homecoming here because the lady and the homeland of the master are constantly changing their shape with the flow of time. It has nothing to do with it. I know von Franz did not like this part of the book. I found it somewhere, I can't remember where, but she said something like, in distinction to Mr. Van Erkelen's, I feel that was a very negative event. He's going to try to make lemonade out of the lemons here, but I think it's just lemons.
What is he trying to say with that statement?
Well, I'm sorry, I think he's a classic codependent who can't call a spade a spade.
Or he's a poet. A frustrated poet with his homeland and stuff.
No, he can't. I don't think he can't deal with the emotions around Pally's demise. And he's trying to pretty it up. It's a tragedy. Period. And we'll see that many places. I mean, I don't not say it to knock the guy. I think he did an enormous amount of work here. And without him, I couldn't even begin to do this. To have found these dreams all over Switzerland, basically, and to have at least given a first start of an interpretation, it's really difficult material. But I also feel he waffles it for a while. Well, okay, what he's going to do now in this chapter is talk about the ring. Rings, centers in general. How important they are. And one of my favorite dreams of Jung is the one he quotes at the bottom, 152. I'll read it. In the center, he's in Liverpool, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been to Liverpool, but I guess it's like the Hammond, Indiana of England. And it's dark, dreary, and what I love so much, oh no, it's here, so I won't say it. So he's walking to the center of town, and the text picks up. In the center was a round pool, and in the middle of it a small island, while everything round about was obscured by rain, fog, smoke, and dimly lit darkness. The little island blazed with sunlight. On it stood a single tree, a magnolia, and a shower of reddish blossoms. It was as though the tree stood in the sunlight and were at the same time the source of the light. My companions commented on the abominable weather and obviously did not see the tree. They spoke of another Swiss who was living in Liverpool and expressed surprise that he should have settled here. That's what I like. I was carried away by the beauty of the flowering tree and the sunlit island and thought, I know very well why he has settled here. Then I awoke. So I understood that to mean this was the portrait of Jung's night sea journey, where he was miserable. And part of him was saying, what am I doing subjecting myself to this misery? And the other part of him knew why he was subjecting himself to that misery, which was he was making a fantastic discovery. And that discovery would be the tree. That's Jungian psychology. Or Jungian psychology is part of that tree. But and the reason Van Erkelen cites that is just to show a different relationship to that center. Here in Pali it's left dangle, and here it's the object of beauty. And all, and he got there by accepting the dark night of the soul. And he painted that. Are you all familiar with those paintings of that dream? Give me a second. Let's see. Why don't we take a break, and while during the break, I'll look for the two pictures, and then we'll come back and pick up with the pictures.